This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The national director indicated that there will be seminal cases that will be enrolled in court in the next 6 months. So this is one of those cases.
That was Matunzi Mahaga, an advocate with South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority on the arrests of senior officials of the government's ports and freight rail company, Transnet, for graft and fraud. Details coming up. Also, gunmen have kidnapped the prelate of the Methodist Church of Nigeria, His Eminence Samuel Kanu Oche. We'll have these stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Sudan's military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has lifted a state of emergency that was imposed when he staged a military coup on October 25th. Security forces also reportedly released dozens of political detainees who have been held in prisons across Sudan. As Nabil Biagio reports from Washington, one Sudanese political analyst says Burhan's measures are not enough to build trust with the civilian opposition and that the international community must take serious measures to hold the coup leaders responsible.
General Burhan issued a decree to lift the seven-month-long state of emergency in Sudan on Sunday, hours after a meeting of Sudan's Transitional Sovereignty Council with the Defense and Security Council in Khartoum. Sudanese Defense Minister and spokesperson for the Transitional Sovereign Council, Yasin Ibrahim, told reporters in Khartoum the Security and Defense Council recommended to Burhan he lift the order to create a conducive environment for dialogue among Sudan's military and civilian actors.
The council has decided to recommend the following. First, lifting the state of emergency imposed across Sudan. Secondly, releasing all those detained based on the emergency law, with the exception of cases that pertain to criminal law and cases of crimes against the state. Thirdly, allowing Al Jazeera Live channel to resume its broadcasting in Sudan.
Sudan's military rulers withdrew the broadcast license of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera in January for what authorities called unprofessional conduct. Authorities also revoked the accreditation of Al Jazeera journalists in Sudan. Sudanese political analyst and professor of history at the University of Missouri, Abdullahi Al Ibrahim, says the decision to lift the state of emergency came after the military failed to win over the civilian opposition and failed to stop street demonstrations against the coup.
There is a serious stalemate in Sudan, a stalemate between the people who supported or initiated the coup and the generality of the population, or what we call the revolutionary side of the equation. The stalemate is real there. The Burhan group are finding it extremely difficult to... They wanted to go it all by themselves, that is alone. They couldn't do that. They wanted to negotiate. Negotiations were not... The other side is not interested.
Ibrahim says lifting the state of emergency is not going to stop the near-daily anti-coup demonstrations in Sudan.
Lifting the emergency laws is irrelevant, really. And they should have started with something else. Because with the emergency law, no one stopped doing whatever the law was issued to stop, like demonstration and all other kinds of activities. We would like to see a serious consideration of the coup of the 25th of October.
The stalemate in Sudan can only be broken by serious measures taken by the international community against Sudan's coup leaders, says Ibrahim.
By the international community taking more drastic steps with the coup, like they started, for example, sanctioning the police component. The American government is sanctioning some departments here and there. We would like to see more of that. We would like to see it directed towards the heads of the, you know, of the restoration, people of the restoration, the symbols of the restoration, specifically Mohammedi.
The lifting of the state of emergency also comes after two anti-coup protesters were killed during demonstrations on Saturday. The head of the UN mission in Sudan, Volker Perthes, tweeted Sunday that he was appalled by the violent death of two young protesters in Khartoum. Perthes once again called for the violence to stop and for ending the state of emergency. The United Nations, the African Union, and IGAD are leading a political process to restore a civilian-led democratic transition in Sudan. The process has achieved little progress since it started early this year. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Around 100 people have died and at least 40 wounded in clashes between gold miners in northern Chad. The clashes occurred in the rugged Tibesti Mountains in the central Sahara, some 1,000 kilometers from Chad's capital, N'Djamena. The French news agency AFP, quoting Defense Minister General Daoud Yahya Brahim, said the clashes were between Mauritanians and Libyans, adding the discovery of gold in the Kouri Bougoudou area near the Libyan border has sparked a rush of miners from across Chad and neighboring countries, and tensions often run high. Daoud spoke to AFP by phone from the area, where he said he was with a large military contingent sent to help restore order. The general said this isn't the first outbreak of violence among gold miners in the region, where the great majority of mines in the area are illegal. He said all gold mining at Kouri has been suspended until further notice. Gunmen have kidnapped the prelate of the Methodist Church of Nigeria, His Eminence Samuel Kanu Uche. Police spokesperson Geoffrey Ogbonna told the Associated Press that the prelate was snatched yesterday along a highway in the Omonochi area in Nigeria's southeastern Abia state. The incident mirrors the troubling security challenges in the West African nation. Two other senior clerics who were with him were also taken hostage. There has been no word yet from the kidnappers, and police spokesman Ogbonna said, adding that efforts are being made to rescue the three captives. The Christian Association of Nigeria condemned the kidnapping and urged President Muhammadu Buhari to order security agencies to free them immediately and stop the incessant abduction of clerics and other innocent Nigerians. Nigeria's southeast has in recent years grappled with violent attacks, many blamed on the indigenous people of Biafra, a leading separatist group. Some African countries with elephant populations say they want to lift an international ban on ivory trading and culling elephant herds. Columbus Mavunga has more from outside Hwenge, Zimbabwe's largest national park.
14 African countries say they want communities with elephant populations to benefit from them. As a result, they issued a communique Thursday after a four-day conference asking for a ban to be lifted on ivory trading and elephant killing. The group plans to take that message to Panama in November for the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, an agreement among governments to ensure that wild animal and plant species are protected. Here is Ngobizita Mangaliso Ndlovu, Zimbabwe's wildlife minister.
Mainly to say, as African states, we hold the significant population of our elephants. It is therefore important that the ideas, the proposals that we are proffering at CITES need to be taken seriously. Key among them, issues of our wildlife products. We are currently spending a lot of money taking custody of our ivory. Which ivory we are restricted from trading. We want to believe that this is one of the key outcomes that we are anticipating to come from CITES, that we can be allowed to plow back into conservation wildlife products.
Zimbabwe says its national parks are home to nearly 100,000 elephants, double the number parks can comfortably accommodate. Government officials say, as a result, the animals are moving out of the parks and destroying local crops. Stembiso Mampo Fusibanda is a 59-year-old Zimbabwean widow living just outside Wange National Park. She says the elephants are bothering locals and invading their fields and homes, and that locals can no longer farm their fields. Farmers are asking for authorities, she says, to build a fence to keep elephants out. Some African countries, such as South Africa, which is home to 45,000 elephants, oppose lifting the ban. Officials there say South Africa uses birth control to manage the elephant population and fences on national park boundaries. Sam Ferreira is a large mammals ecologist at South Africa National Parks.
One of the difficulties is people tend to think that the African manager of wildlife has got only one solution. In fact, they don't. They go through some very serious thinking about what can I do before they get to the really hard, difficult ones. Now I have to permanently remove an animal.
The European Union opposes lifting the ban on elephant ivory trading and questions the data Zimbabwe used to estimate of its elephant population. Timo Okenen, the European Union ambassador to Zimbabwe.
I think my understanding is that there's information required about carrying capacities and so forth. So I think there's probably work to be done.
Zimbabwe accuses the European Union and other Western countries of influencing CITES to keep the ban on trading ivory, which was implemented to protect dwindling numbers of elephant species from poachers on the continent. The ban has encouraged the growth of elephant populations, but it is also causing problems for people like Sibanda. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Wange, Zimbabwe.
An Egyptian court sentenced former presidential candidate Abdul Monim Abul Fattah to 15 years in prison yesterday for spreading false news and incitement against state institutions. The French news agency AFP quoted judicial sources as saying he was sentenced with 24 others, including members of the Muslim Brotherhood group. Amnesty International condemned the rulings, describing the trial as grossly unfair and politically motivated, and alleging that the defendants had been subjected to a litany of abuses, including torture. In 2012, Abul Fattah was among a number of candidates who ran unsuccessfully in elections that saw the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi voted into power. Morsi's divisive rule lasted for just a year. He was ousted by then Defense Minister Abdel Fattah al-Sisi following mass protests in July 2013. The Brotherhood was subsequently declared a terrorist organization, and thousands of its members and sympathizers were arrested in an ensuing crackdown. An April mob attack in northern Ethiopia that left at least 30 Muslims dead and 100 injured has fueled revenge attacks on Christians. Witnesses and community leaders spoke with VOA about what they believe led to the violence. For VOA, Henry Wilkins reports from Gondar, Ethiopia.
Gondar is still reeling from a deadly mob attack in April, which occurred during the funeral of a Muslim scholar. The United Nations says it's deeply concerned about what it calls interreligious clashes in this and other parts of Ethiopia. The country is locked in a vicious civil war, and analysts warn religious violence could add to its list of problems. The attack happened at the Saturday market in Gondar. Some residents say it was just Muslims who were killed, others say it was Christians too. The incident sparked retaliatory violence and protests across the country, including in the capital, Addis Ababa, where there was damage to buildings downtown. Gondar authorities have kept a close eye on independent reporting while government-run Ethio Telecom restricted internet access throughout the city, but VOA was able to speak with witnesses. Asnaku Kasi was at the funeral for the victims that day. He says that at the end of the funeral ceremony, Muslim youths took heavy stones from a nearby churchyard to encircle the scholar's grave. That is when youths from both sides began fighting, he claims, adding it was chaos. Other witnesses said the violence was premeditated, deliberately targeting Muslims over the course of several days. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has called on authorities to investigate what happened. Police say they have launched an inquiry. But a Christian community leader in Gondar, Yusuf Desta, criticised the UN and said the violence was an isolated incident and that relations between Christians and Muslims in the city are good. The violence, he said, is fuelled by some with a political agenda, including rebel groups. He says the Ethiopian Orthodox Church believes the conflict has been imported from somewhere else, using religion as a cover. External forces, particularly those forces who have political interests, are behind the conflict, he added, citing Tigrayan forces, TPLF, among others. However, a leader from the Gondar Islamic Council, Mola Yibri, says the violence has been brewing for years. He believes the signs have been there since 2016, when Muslims identified and reported discrimination to government authorities. He says improper religious teachings and preaching that some religious institutions are superior to others was one sign. There was graffiti on local taxis that dehumanised people, he says. A representative of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church in Gondar said there may be rogue preachers who engage in this kind of rhetoric, but they do not represent the institution. One analyst says the Gondar conflict may be linked to both regional and religious identity. The Amhara region, where Gondar is situated, has seen a recent surge in ethnic nationalism. Ostebo Turje is the director of the Department of Religion at the University of Florida.
You know, it's interesting when it comes to the Amhara region. Muslims in Gondar and Gojam and so on, they don't refer to themselves as Amhara. They never have done. I mean, some young now will do. So Amhara in that area means Christian. And I think that's an important part when it comes to how complex ethnic identity is.
As investigations continue, the atmosphere in Gondar remains tense. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Gondar, Ethiopia.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. The Democratic Republic of Congo on Saturday summoned Rwanda's ambassador and suspended Rwanda Air flights to the DRC in response to what it called Kigali's support for M23 rebels carrying out a military offensive in its eastern borderlands. Rwanda has denied this, calling the fighting an intra-Congolese conflict. The two governments regularly accuse each other of backing armed rebel groups it is seeking to squash. Senegalese President Macky Sall, the African Union's current chairman, has called for dialogue between the two countries due to the escalating tensions. South African state prosecutors have fired their first shots in what they expect to be a long legal war against those who allegedly stole billions of taxpayer rands when Jacob Zuma was president between 2009 and 2018. On Friday, investigators from the National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, arrested five current and former senior officials of the government ports and freight rail company Transnet. A commission of inquiry earlier this year found that Zuma appointed cronies to loot state-owned enterprises in a scheme known as state capture. Darren Taylor reports.
The five men include Zuma ally and former Transnet CEO Siyabonga Gama. They appeared in court on Friday on charges of fraud, corruption and money laundering. A magistrate released them on bail and told them to be back in court in mid-July. According to the NPA, the five channeled irregular fees to consulting companies, mostly linked to Zuma's friends and alleged co-conspirators in state capture, AJ Atul and Rajesh Gupta. The NPA says the Gupta brothers now based in India and the United Arab Emirates, paid Gama and the others bribes and kickbacks to get bogus contracts. They, Zuma and the Guptas, deny any wrongdoing. International consulting firm McKinsey pledged last year to repay almost 900 million rands it received from Transnet. It said while some of its employees made errors of judgment in South Africa, none had been implicated in crime. NPA advocate Mtunzi Maga says the arrests of the Transnet Five represent just the beginning of the authority living up to a recent promise.
The national director had indicated that there will be seminal cases that will be enrolled in court in the next 6 months, so this is one of those cases.
The NPA's next target is Zuma himself. The former president, along with French weapons company Thales, faces charges including fraud, racketeering and money laundering related to a mid-1990s arms deal. This isn't linked to state capture, but the NPA expects the trial to be the first of many court appearances by Zuma connected to crimes he allegedly committed mostly during the final 4 years of his presidency from 2014 to 2018. Maga says last week's dismissal of Zuma's legal application for the prosecutor involved in the case to be recused means it's time for the former president to get his long-awaited day in court.
We will channel all our resources in ensuring that we oppose any further postponement because we believe it is not in the interest of any of the parties for the matter to be further delayed. So we're hoping that by the 15th of August, we will not have any further delays in the matter. Our witnesses will be ready to testify against the two accused so that we can sustain the charges against them.
Zuma's spokesperson, Mzwanele Manyi, says all allegations against the former president, including that he's the architect of state capture, are false. He told State TV all the so-called media exposés linking Zuma to corruption mean he's already been found guilty in the court of public opinion.
It looks like the system is working to ensure that there is an unfair trial, because we've got the NPA that is not doing things on this side, and we've got all these negative assumptions being put in. So the climate, the environment, everything is just laying a negative foundation, which is bad for justice in this country. It does not inspire confidence.
But one of South Africa's most astute political analysts, Ralph Mateka, says the charging of the Transnet Five plus Zuma's trial will be the beginning of citizens finally seeing justice after decades of ruling party impunity. He expects the court cases promised by the NPA to directly implicate senior African National Congress officials in plundering state companies. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Regis Audrius, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, persistent drought and overwhelming floods are wreaking havoc across the world, including the African continent, threatening not only livelihoods, but the very fabric of society. How can African countries best deal with this radically changing reality? That's Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
All the news and programs about Africa and the world are available to you around the clock on voaafrica.com. Our team is working on updating the news and updating new programs minute by minute to be at the tip of your fingertips. Make it a habit to visit our website, voaafrica.com. You will be glad you did.